morning again. The court will now hear oral argument in the case of U.S. v. Stanley. Counsel for the appellant.
May it please the court, Mary Hall and Captain John Shriver for the appellant, Sergeant Aaron Stanley. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
Granted.
Your Honor's instructions are supposed to serve as guideposts during deliberations to provide members with a means of engaging in an informed deliberation on guilt or innocence. But we submit that the self-defense instruction in this case was not a guidepost. If anything, it was a barrier. It was a barrier because it essentially blocked the members from considering how evidence involving escalation and inability to withdraw figured into the defense theory of the case. We further submit that this was not harmless error. The panel could very well have believed that appellant's version of events was what happened, and that's why he shot his two friends. But they may have felt boxed into finding him guilty, even though they believed his testimony, because of the faulty instruction.
Counsel,
where in the record did the defense set forth their theory of escalation?
Well, I think it's self-evident from the evidence as it was presented, if I may address escalation at this point.
But did they argue that to the military judge at all?
I don't believe the word escalation was emphasized to the judge. I believe what happened was the evidence as it was developed at trial showed that Sergeant Werner was the first to use a deadly weapon when he used a knife, and that appellant only fired in the kitchen after he had been fired upon by Sergeant Heimer.
But I'm trying to get to whether the defense at trial felt that escalation was an issue, and if they didn't argue that or ask specifically for that, what are we to take from that?
Well, first with that, Your Honor, I'd like to address the fact that because this was an affirmative defense, it was not affirmatively waived by the defense at trial. Both parties, for whatever reason, I expect it was so that they could prime their voir dire questions accordingly, asked the military judge to give the self-defense instruction before voir dire. And unfortunately, we don't know from the record what dialogue may have occurred between the parties in determining whether or not there was any reference to what would go into that self-defense instruction. I've been operating on the assumption myself that counsel have simply looked in the bench book. That was the instruction that was in the bench book. But it still gets back to the military judge. The buck stops with the military judge.
Counsel, your complaint, as I understand it, and the theory you're arguing, is that this instruction was prejudicially incomplete.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay. The military judge said that the defense said we propose to raise this defense. The judge said, fine. I proposed to instruct along these lines and gave a rather detailed picture of what he was going to say. Then he said to counsel, do you have anything to add or do you object? And counsel said, no. Why is that not an affirmative waiver of precisely what you're advancing?
It's a forfeiture by omission, but not an affirmative.
Wait a minute, counsel. Do you want me to add anything? No. Why is that not an affirmative waiver? He didn't sit there silent. He said no when asked precisely the question you're now advancing.
Well, Your Honor, if there was a failure on the part of the defense to roger up with, hey, we would like this specific instruction or we make an objection under Cardwell, it's ultimately the judge's responsibility to give correct instructions on an affirmative defense. Now, if the defense counsel had stood up and said, but you know, Your Honor, I really don't think we want to get into this escalation thing, so we ask that you not give an instruction on self-defense.
So it's not enough to say, I have nothing to add. Defense counsel would have to say, I don't want this added.
Yes, I think the defense counsel would have to do more than simply saying, I have no objection.
He didn't say, I have no objection. He did say that, but he also said, I don't want anything added.
Understood. And my position on that would remain the same, Your Honor, because it is not a reflection of an intentional construing of the defense theory of the case. The evidence was ample that there had been escalation here, and the scenario that played out at the farmhouse showed that appellant, although he had the opportunity to escalate matters himself, did not do so. He did not fire until he had been fired upon.
Question. When did appellant's right of self-defense first arise?
I believe it first arose when he looked out the crack in the door in the arms closet in the weight room, and he saw that Specialist Heimer had what he believed to be a weapon in his hand.
So when Werner threatened his life and he fled to the farmhouse or went to the farmhouse to get rid of the drugs, he did not have the right to defend himself at that point in response to Werner's threat on his life?
If it had been an immediate threat under the same roof, then perhaps a good person, an objective person, would have found that to be reasonable under the circumstances. But they weren't yet under the same roof. It was not until Werner and Heimer came out to the farmhouse and appellant was in the back room and he looked through the crack.
What about the fact that appellant and Colvin staged weapons, brought weapons to the house and staged them? Does that not immediately introduce the element of potential deadly force?
The weapons, there were weapons pre-existing at the farmhouse. They did target shooting at the farmhouse. Now, there was a pistol.
But the record reflects they brought a pistol out.
That's true.
And that they placed, a sniper rifle by the front door.
It was Colvin who had placed the sniper rifle there. He had carried it to the door as he answered. Now, in Colvin's mind and Stanley's mind, there was concern that Werner may be carrying out his threat, but at the same point, too.
But you do not believe they had the right of self-defense at that time, notwithstanding Werner's previous threat?
I believe they had it as soon as Werner showed up at the farmhouse, but appellant did not see Werner immediately at the farmhouse because he was in the back room.
If they had it when Werner showed up at the farmhouse, why wasn't it ongoing then throughout, in which case there was no escalation? It was an ongoing event.
Well, that would imply that there was a mutual aspect to this. And if I may get back to Heimer walking by the room, appellant did not jump out and immediately shoot Heimer. Arguably, under self-defense, he may have felt at liberty to do so if he believed that Heimer was armed. But he held off. He did not shoot at that point. When he went in the kitchen, even though there was some concern about whether or not Werner was armed, he chose to search Werner rather than shoot Werner at that point. Appellant did not fire a weapon at that farmhouse until he had been fired upon by Heimer. But if I may add, Your Honor, the point at which mutual combat starts and the point at which any escalation may have occurred was ultimately a matter for the jury after they had been properly instructed. There may be five varying opinions at the court as to when mutual combat started in this case. I would submit that that would be an indication of how this was simply an issue that the jury needed to resolve after they had been properly instructed.
Counsel, if one person has no weapon and another person has a knife and appellant has the gun, who is it that escalated the fight?
Well, it's the sequence of events that it's sort of like fingers being intertwined, and I think we need to go back and look again at Werner started the fight by a bare fist fight against Colvin. Those two wrestle to the ground, punching, kicking. Werner is biting Colvin at that point, and then Werner reaches out, grabs a knife, and stabs Colvin and slices his ear down to the...
Okay, so we have fists, and now we have a knife.
We now have a knife.
And who's the first person that brandishes a gun?
That would be appellant, but only because he thought Heimer had a gun in his hand. As he looked out through that peek in the hinge door of the closet and thought he saw a gun in Heimer's hand.
But at some point he realized that that wasn't a gun.
He did, but as he came out, he brandished the weapon to get control of the situation. He didn't use it immediately, and I think that's a significant distinction in the case, is that he did not pop out of the closet and start firing thinking that Werner and Heimer were about to kill him.
But now he has a gun, right, and someone else has a gun. Where's the escalation?
There's no escalation at that point between those two. But when appellant goes into the kitchen and checks Heimer, sees that there's no weapon, and then starts to check Werner, that's when Heimer picks up the rifle in the corner, starts to trigger, or pulls the trigger. There's no round in the chamber, and then does put a round in the chamber and shoots at appellant, who is trying to run. Appellant had tried to get that rifle away from Heimer with no success, and instead turned and bolted out onto the porch. It was at that point that the first person actually fired a firearm, and that was Heimer shooting that rifle at appellant, who's armed at this point with only a .22 handgun, faced with an attack by somebody who has a bolt-action rifle.
Okay, so appellant had two weapons, two guns, when he came out, a rifle and a pistol?
That's in dispute, Your Honor. Colvin said that he did, but frankly, it doesn't make much sense.
Well, the way I read the testimony was he had two weapons when he came, two guns when he came out. He put one down. He still had the pistol. Then he came out in response to Colvin's cry that his ear was being cut off by Werner, and then the chambered round and the click and the mutual affray began.
Well, again, Your Honor, I think there was a dispute as to whether or not appellant brought that rifle out and put it into the corner. Colvin said that he had. Appellant said that he wasn't sure how it had gotten there, but...
But it was Colvin...
It was definitely in the corner of the kitchen. How it got there and when...
But one of those two people, Stanley or Colvin, put it there.
Yes.
To the extent there's variance, it's
right.
Stanley
is,
or Colvin.
This is one of their discrepancies in their testimonies. But Heimer gets that weapon, goes to pull the trigger. There's no round in the chamber, and then does put a round in the chamber and shoots at appellant. So at that point, appellant turns around and fires a .22 pistol at this man carrying this bolt-action rifle until the...
What caliber was the bolt-action rifle, or do you know? Is it in the record?
Not my strong suit, Your Honor.
You keep emphasizing that the pistol was a .22.
It's a much larger caliber, but I may be confusing it with the sniper rifle that was on the front porch.
Never mind.
So,
with respect to which shooting is it that you alleged that the escalation language was required, or is it with respect to both?
It was required for both, Your Honor, although we haven't addressed yet the stabbing, appellant's belief that there was going to be another stabbing in the kitchen, but it would be to both. That with regards to his killing of Heimer, appellant was entitled to an escalation instruction because Heimer had fired at him first. So that was the escalation. It wasn't just that they were each holding a weapon, it was that Heimer actually fired his weapon. With regards to standing in the shoes of Sergeant Colvin, with regards to shooting Sergeant Werner, the escalation in that case occurred because, according to appellant, when Colvin cried, "No, Heimer," from the kitchen, and appellant turned around to see what Colvin was saying, it was at that point, according to Sergeant Stanley, that he saw Sergeant Werner in back of Sergeant Colvin with a knife moving towards Sergeant Colvin in what the appellant believed was an attempt to stab Sergeant Colvin.
That's a defense of another instruction, which he did get.
It was, but it was similarly restricted. The language was, if you believe that Colvin was the aggressor or a mutual combatant, that Stanley could not lawfully use force on Colvin's behalf. So, of course, any time that you defend a third party, it's at your own risk. But the same flaw in the instruction that was given with regards to the only way a mutual combatant can regain the right to self-defense is by a good faith ability to withdraw, that error was permeated in the instruction or passed on in the instruction with regards to the third party defense as well.
I have two questions. One, is it fair to say that your theory of escalation and argument is based on viewing this as not one continuous event but a series of events?
Yes, Your Honor.
Or a series of timelines. Is that fair
to
say?
It is. How the events unfolded at the in the farmhouse kitchen, and it is uncontroverted that Heimer was the first to actually fire a weapon.
I understand that. And how long, what is the range of testimony as to how long all of this occurred in?
Repeated references.
That's part of the first question, by the way.
Repeated references, Your Honor, to the fact that this was just a fast-moving situation. One could almost read the scenario of events and think it may have played out in less than 2 minutes if it's as quick as the record seems to imply that it was. Not a lot of...
Is that your inference, or does the testimony, does someone say 2 minutes?
No, I don't record anything. I don't recall any part of the record that says an exact time.
But you would say that as a matter of argument, that's a fair inference from reading the record.
It could be as less as that. That would be my inference, but it's based on appellant's repeated references to the fact that this was so fast-moving and it played out so quickly. I just, when I look at the scenario, I think it could have played out as low as 2 minutes.
My second question is, presuming for the sake of argument, that one gets to the harmless beyond reasonable doubt analysis or not, what is your response to the physical evidence and blood, well, I guess that's physical too, the blood spatter evidence and the low trajectory of the rounds that hit Werner? If you look at the pictures, they're just off the floor, the trajectories. And the CCA relies on that to say if there was error, it would be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. What's your response to the testimony of the blood spatter expert and the trajectory expert? And I'm making you go over time, and you're allowed to answer the question. Isn't that clever?
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, as we pointed out in our brief, we believe that the crime scene had been contaminated and that there was a discrepancy between even the government experts as to what Werner's position had been in at the time that he had been shot. One of the government experts, Mr. Jason, relied on Colvin's claim on the eve of trial practically that Werner's head had been propped up, and yet Dr. Posman, who was the forensic pathologist, testified that no, the body would have had to have been torqued to the right and the torso off the floor in order for that shot to occur.
You still have extremely low trajectories. And how do you deal with the low trajectory? Your answer is crime scene contamination?
No, Your Honor. Thank you for letting me clarify that. But my answer would be, as the body is falling backwards, as Sergeant Werner's body is falling backwards, the shots range lower based on the fact that it was bam, 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 rapid fire. And my number of bams that I just used is not necessarily
right.
reflective of how many bullets were fired.
Counsel, with respect to the matter of harmlessness, how do you distinguish between those matters that are for us to decide with respect to the facts and those that is uncontroverted, and those matters that are controverted would be for the court-martial panel to decide on the issue of harmlessness?
Your Honor, I think one of the flaws in the lower court's analysis is the degree to which it gauged the credibility of two witnesses who both had credibility issues in terms of their veracity at trial, because even appellant admitted at one point that he had lied to a law enforcement officer. So we believe that the lower court was flawed to the extent that it relied so heavily on credibility and equivocal forensic findings. And in looking at those, they did not pay enough attention to what the defense theory of the case appeared to have been based on the evidence as it was developed. And I would also add, if I may, that they also didn't focus enough on how much the trial counsel emphasized mutual combatant, no self-defense, mutual combatant, no self-defense. It was almost the mantra of the trial counsel, not just during voir dire, but especially on his arguments.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Judge Baker, members of the court. May it please the court, my name is Captain Julie Glascock, and I, along with Major LeJean White, represent the government. The government requests that you affirm the lower court's decision because the military judge did not err in this case. However, if this court does find plain and obvious error, any error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Is the standard review plain error?
Yes, Your Honor, that's what I believe it is. Turning to the military judge's instruction, the military judge properly instructed the panel on all issues reasonably raised by the evidence. No other instructions were required. RCM 920 Alpha requires the military judge to give the panel appropriate instructions on findings. Further, U.S. v. McDonald requires the military judge to sua sponte, give certain instructions when the evidence reasonably raises the issue, even if not affirmatively requested. Two affirmative defenses in this case were raised.
So wait, why is it plain error then, if the judge is supposed to do it affirmatively regardless?
Your Honor,
do we review that part for plain error?
Do we review, I'm sorry, Your Honor?
If the judge has a sua sponte duty to do something, how do we review that for plain error?
Your Honor, in U.S. v. McMurrin, we turn to U.S. v. McMurrin for that principle. And in that case that was decided earlier this year, the judge, even though having a sua sponte duty to give the instruction, when he gave an erroneous instruction because the change of law that followed the trial, this court used plain error.
Well, so what change of law was there, but what's the change in law in this case?
Your Honor, at the time of trial, the only case that had been decided was U.S. v. Cardwell. The escalation of force doctrine was then clarified, and it was told to the judge that they were required to give this instruction in the cases that followed in 2006 and 2007, Deering and Lewis. So it's that clarification of the escalation of force doctrine.
Did either Deering or Lewis state that they were stating new law, or are they stating that they were setting forth the law as the court determined it existed?
Your Honor, this court in Deering stated they weren't stating necessarily new law, but that they were certainly making sure that at future court-martials, this was going to be an instruction that would be needed to be instructed.
So how does that play into the McMurrin theory?
The same thing happened there, Your Honor. Very similar situation. In that case, the law was given for a lesser-included offense that this court later found out was not a lesser-included offense. Because the law had changed in between when the trial was heard at trial and here, the plain error standard was used.
Well, LIO was a true change in law. The other is just a clarification or an elaboration.
Yes, Your Honor.
I thought the whole point of Lewis is that it wasn't inconsistent with anything that had been decided before and that it wasn't inconsistent with the RCM.
Yes, Your Honor.
So they failed to object, but if the military judge had a sui sponte duty to clarify and give further instruction, why would it be plain error?
Why would it be plain error if the military judge failed to give the instruction?
Because he was required to give, if assuming that we believe, as possibly we do or maybe we don't, but assuming that we all believe that Lewis and Deering weren't new law, and that the law at the time of this trial required him to give the entire instruction.
Because in Deering, Cardwell focused on inappropriate advice of the law in an SJR. In Deering, that was when it was put forth that at a military court-martial, this instruction was necessary. So it elaborated and put it further on to court-martials. However, even if this court decides to use the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, which is essentially the third element of the plain error, we feel that we can prevail.
Counsel, it looks to me like there's three ways you can view this situation. One is that all of these people were mutual combatants and there was no real escalation. One, that Stanley escalated it, and the other, that Heimer and Werner escalated it at various times. Is it your argument that there is no evidence in the record that supports the fact that Heimer or Werner escalated it or that Stanley escalated it? I mean, it seems to me that there was testimony that could, if believed, could establish that.
Your Honor, it's our position that appellant came into the situation with the maximum amount of force, with that .22 caliber semi-automatic pistol, and from there, no escalation could have occurred.
That's your position.
That is our position.
But the way the testimony came in, could not the members of the panel have believed something else? I mean, your position is your position, but wasn't there some evidence introduced that could have allowed them to believe that?
I don't believe so.
Do you have a case that stands for the proposition that if someone comes to the party, so to speak, with a loaded gun in their hand, that the fact that someone else gets a gun and then shoots first is not an escalation?
No, Your Honor, we do not. However, in the Deering, Cardwell, Lewis trilogy of cases, there seems to indicate that there needs to be that clear ratcheting up of force, that there needs to be that simple assault followed by an escalation of force, and then the instruction to be provided for that retaliation.
Did the appellant have a duty to retreat?
Appellant was in his own home and didn't necessarily have a duty to retreat, but the appellant could have.
What controls that? State law, our jurisprudence? What? Where do we find that?
Whether or not
he had a duty to retreat and what the effect of his being in his own house was.
Well, certainly we can turn to RCM 916, which gives the self-defense instruction and addresses the duty to withdraw. That would be the first place to turn. But turning to the Cardwell-Deering-Lewis trilogy of cases, the military judge needs to be looking for two things to determine whether or not that escalation of force instruction is warranted. And first, he's going to be looking to determine whether or not there is mutual combat occurring or who the initial aggressor was. For it's only a mutual combatant or initial aggressor who would need to avail themselves of this instruction. And second, the military judge is going to be looking to determine whether or not the opponent escalated the force. Turning first to the situation involving Specialist Heimer and appellant shooting him in self-defense, the defense argued that Specialist Heimer escalated when he misfired and then fired that rifle at appellant. But according to appellant's own testimony, it was appellant who emerged from the arms room with that fully loaded semi-automatic pistol and immediately held Specialist Heimer at gunpoint. And he had Specialist Heimer put his hands up and ordered him into the kitchen, effectively taking him hostage. And then it was at gunpoint that appellant searched Specialist Heimer, in his words, as if he were an enemy prisoner of war. Appellant stated that he found no weapons on Specialist Heimer and that Specialist Heimer was not a threat to him. Still,
is escalation a factual determination or a legal determination?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, can you repeat that? I'm having
trouble. Is escalation a factual determination or a legal determination?
Certainly it would be a factual determination. However, in order for the instruction to be given, the judge needs to make that determination whether or not the evidence reasonably raises it. Here, the evidence didn't suggest it was reasonably raised by the facts. After the appellant realized that Specialist Heimer was no threat, to exert control over Specialist Heimer, he still held him at gunpoint, had him go on his stomach with his hands and his legs out, and had him stay there. And it was only at that point that Specialist Heimer grabbed that bolt-action rifle, misfired, and then fired it at appellant. And it was in response to this shot that appellant claims that he regained the right to self-defense. But that argument fails for two reasons. First, the appellant came into the situation with the maximum amount of force possible under any sort of situation. And two, Specialist Heimer was reasonably justified to protect himself with lethal force in response to appellant's earlier action.
How does that address the issue of escalation, and particularly in the context of the arguments that the government offered at trial with respect to mutual combatants?
Well, at that point, Your Honor, if I'm understanding correctly, there was no mutual combat between Specialist Heimer and appellant.
Was that the position of the government at trial?
Was that the government's position at trial, Your Honor?
Yeah. Didn't the government argue at trial that we had one way to look at this was a mutual combatant situation?
Yes, at certain times, yes, Your Honor. They were unclear in their closing argument as to when mutual combat was occurring. But yes, they did argue mutual combat.
Yeah. Counsel, you said earlier that when Stanley came out of the closet that he had this pistol.
Yes, Your Honor.
And he held these other guys at bay and he searched them and everything.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then I guess it was Heimer that picked up the rifle and fired at him. Where was the pistol at that point?
In Sergeant Stanley's hand.
Okay.
He never put it down.
So, question. At the time, after being held at gunpoint by the appellant, was Heimer, would he have been entitled to a self-defense instruction?
Yes, Your Honor. Had Specialist Heimer fired that rifle and actually did what he had intended to do, it's likely he would have been trying and asserting his own justification of self-defense.
Because he was responding to being held at gunpoint.
Yes, Your Honor. And under what he was going at that point, a reasonable person would have felt that their life or grievous bodily harm was imminent, and he was entitled to then use that force.
Where did the rifle come from?
It was from the corner of the room, Your Honor. The appellant said that he did not bring it into the room. Sergeant Colvin testified that he came out with both the pistol and the rifle.
So who's supposed to make that decision as to what happened? Us, the CCA, the court-martial panel?
Well, the court-martial panels would be the one to make that decision. However, under all fact scenarios, at one point that rifle was in that doorway, and it's that rifle that Sergeant Colvin, Specialist Heimer grabbed.
What decision did the CCA make at that point?
CCA didn't make a decision on that point, Your Honor. Moving on, I'd like to...
What about the CCA's determination that they believe Sergeant Colvin? Why isn't that a determination at that point?
Yes, Your Honor. The CCA didn't come out and say that they believe Sergeant Colvin over Sergeant Stanley just because he's a more believable guy.
No, I understand that. Okay. I understand they had a rationale for it related to the forensic evidence. My question is, in determining that they believe Sergeant Colvin's testimony versus the appellant's testimony in this case, why aren't they making a determination that they believe at that point that Colvin's testimony as to the source of that weapon?
Because, Your Honor, I don't believe that it was necessary for them to come to make that determination, to come to the decision that they eventually came to in their opinion.
I understand your answer. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Moving on, I'd like to turn to the shooting of Sergeant Warner by appellant in defense of Sergeant Colvin. Again, I focus on appellant's testimony for argument's sake. This incident begins immediately after appellant had shot Specialist Heimer. And if we turn to Joint Appendix 453, three very critical events happen. First, Sergeant Colvin screamed, "No, Heimer," and looked in the direction of appellant and Specialist Heimer. Appellant then looked over and saw that Sergeant Coleman and Sergeant Warner had stopped fighting. And then he saw that Sergeant Warner was coming from behind Sergeant Coleman and tried to stab him in the back with a knife. In response, appellant shot and killed Sergeant Warner. And under these set of instructions, the correct and only instruction that was required to be given was that defensive other instruction. Appellant testified that the fight had broken up. Appellant testified that Sergeant Warner was behind Sergeant Colvin. Sergeant Colvin didn't even know what Sergeant Warner was doing at that point in time. And appellant testified that Sergeant Warner tried to stab Sergeant Colvin in the back. Under appellant's own facts, appellant would have been justified in defending Sergeant Colvin with lethal force, drawing the defense of others' instruction. And the fact pattern only requires the defense of other instruction be given, and it was. The escalation of force instruction was not warranted. However, appellant's own testimony for both Sergeant Warner and Specialist Heimer require only the self-defense instruction and the defense of other instruction be given, and they both properly were. The escalation of force issue and instruction was not reasonably raised by the evidence and was not required to be given by the military judge.
Was the military judge at that point, in terms of the instructions that he gave, did that leave the members with the view that if they viewed this as a mutual combatant situation, then they would not apply the defense either of defense of self or defense of other?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so. And the reason for that is because even though it was the mutual combat, even if the judge did make that determination, there still has to be that identification of the escalation of force.
My question wasn't whether the escalation was required. My question was, based on the judge's instructions, if the members viewed the situation as one of mutual combatant situation, then they would not, under the judge's instructions, give the defendant either self-defense or defense of others as a defense in this case. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes, Your Honor. And if this court does find plain and obvious error, the government requests this court find, as the lower court did, that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. In U.S. v. Deering, it states that an instructional error is harmless if it appears beyond a reasonable doubt that the error complained of did not contribute to the verdict obtained. And at trial, the government provided overwhelming evidence of guilt. The government based its theory on Sergeant Colvin's testimony and then presented several forensic scientists to demonstrate how Sergeant Colvin's testimonies was consistent with the extensive forensic evidence collected at the farmhouse. Sergeant Colvin testified that appellant shot Specialist Heimer as he was running away from him and then later as he was laying face down on the ground. And Sergeant Colvin testified that appellant shot Sergeant Warner as he laid in the kitchen floor pleading for his life. And to corroborate this testimony, the government put on an expert forensic pathologist who testified that the direction of the wounds in both victims were consistent with Sergeant Colvin's testimony.
Could they have been consistent, as appellant argued, with in Warner's case, with someone falling and being shot at the same time?
Your Honor, we had testimony from Mr. Alexander, who is a certified senior crime scene analyst who was declared an expert in shooting incident reconstruction, in crime scene analysis, and bloodstain pattern analysis.
Focus on the question, though.
Yes, Your Honor. He testified that the evidence was not consistent with Sergeant Warner falling at that time.
Was there any evidence that, was that the only evidence on this point?
To tie it all together, yes, Your Honor. The defense put on Mr. Pex as their expert, and he suggested that perhaps Sergeant Colvin wasn't correct, but he never made any definitive statement saying that this was something that was consistent with the facts or that something was consistent that happened.
Well, under those circumstances, is it the government's argument that the defense did not put on any evidence at all to raise questions in a reasonable doubt situation about the whether the testimony of the government's expert would prove the case? That is the question. Are you saying that the defense did not put on any contrary evidence in this case?
No, Your Honor. They put on two. Well, they used one of the government's own experts on their own case, no. And they also put on a second expert. But the evidence that they put on was really to show how Sergeant Colvin was incorrect, and no affirmative evidence to show how appellant's testimony was correct.
Well, okay. Why are they obligated to put on that testimony? That is, if they've raised questions about the credibility and validity of Colvin's testimony, isn't that a determination for the court-martial panel to make?
Certainly, Your Honor, and it is the government's burden to show beyond a reasonable doubt that Sergeant Colvin's testimony was consistent with the evidence. Yes, Your Honor.
My question had to do with whether there was testimony by the government regarding the trajectory of the rounds that hit Werner. Appellant has argued that their explanation for the nature of the trajectory was that Werner was falling back at the time he was shot. Is there evidence in the record put on by any side that would put in doubt whether the Werner was shot, the trajectory was consistent with someone who was prone or was consistent with someone who was fallen?
Your Honor.
Not whether the defense contested other stuff, just on this particular factual point, please.
Yes. The expert that testified, Dr. Pojman, who testified for both the government and the defense in their case in chief, testified that the Sergeant Werner would have had to have been up somewhere above the ground and somewhat 90 degrees. So that was the evidence that used through the same expert that came out. Now with him falling back, they didn't suggest that expert did not testify as to him falling back. So my answer at this point, from my recollection of the record, is that there was no evidence by the defense stating that he was falling back at the time.
And I'm sure the defense will correct their view of it as it is. Other questions?
Yeah, I have one. Okay. Let's assume Colvin's testimony. He came out with two weapons. He put one down. The fight on the floor with the St. Peter type knifing in the air is over. Okay. Now he has a pistol. Behind him, he hears Heimer chamber around, didn't chamber around, click, and then Heimer shoots at him. Why isn't that an escalation?
Your Honor, because at that point in time, Specialist Heimer felt that he was having lethal force exerted against him. And it's Specialist Heimer's opinion.
Lethal force? It wasn't the appellant's back turned.
Not according to Sergeant Colvin's testimony, which...
Okay, the appellant was facing Heimer when Heimer did this.
Yes.
According to Colvin's testimony.
According to Colvin's testimony, Specialist Heimer was in the vision of appellant. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And he shot at him and missed.
He shot at him and missed.
Okay. And that's not an escalation?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
I see I've gone over my time. If I may briefly conclude, Your Honor. The appellant's assignment of error is without merit, and the government asked the court answer the granted issue in the negative. Thank you very much.
Is there a rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
First point I'd like to address is that there was no duty to retreat on the part of Sergeant Stanley. He was lawfully in his farmhouse, and I believe the law recognizes that there's no duty to retreat if you're in a place to which you're lawfully entitled to be in the first place. Secondly, and I think this with regard to Judge Ryan's question about brandishing the weapon as he was coming out, I don't have a case to cite to the court at this point, but I would be happy to research that and provide case law in the future, but I do have a bench book instruction from the bench book that was in operation at the time of appellant's trial that says that a person may, acting in self-defense in order to frighten or discourage an assailant, threaten more force than he is legally allowed to use under the circumstances. So if the theory of self-defense is protection, an apple for an apple, an orange for an orange, then when appellant looked out the crack in the door and saw Heimer, thought that he had a pistol in his hand, then appellant came out and did not use the pistol, did not fire the pistol, and simply brandished it to take control of the situation. Again, if the court wishes, I'd be happy to pursue that line of research and provide case law to the court, but all I can cite at this point is instruction 5-TAC-2-TAC-5 of the military judge's bench book.
Understanding that the judge has an affirmative duty to give an instruction if the evidence so indicates, why is it relevant, and to what extent, or how do you address the fact that the appellant did not ask for this instruction? The judge is certainly taking into account that the appellant's own version of the events does not compel him to ask for the instruction.
I think, frankly, Your Honor, the parties were operating off of the standard bench book instruction, which reflected the manual provision. The manual provision, as Judge Ryan pointed out, didn't discuss escalation and didn't discuss an ability to withdraw, and that's why Deering and Lewis simply sort of painted in some of the corners of the Cardwell doctrine. This military judge actually authored an article around the same time frame that was cited by this court in the motion for reconsideration in Deering, and in that article he actually cited Cardwell as still good law in 2005.
So is it just reviewing it for plain error because there's a change in the law?
No, we don't believe that plain error applies, Your Honor, and there was no change in the law. This was simply Cardwell never changed. What changed was that a counsel at trial in Deering used Cardwell to ask for a specific instruction, and then Lewis sort of built off of that. But it wasn't new law. It was simply...
So if it wasn't new law, and if the theory was out there, if the defense believed it was entitled to the instruction, to the amplification of the instruction that was given, because you're not disputing that a self-defense instruction was given, you just think that this additional verbiage should have been added.
Right? And it was critical verbiage, Your Honor, because...
Right, then why, if it was so critical, didn't the defense ask for it? Why isn't that waiver?
We don't think that constitutes an affirmative waiver for a counsel to rely on the bench book when the bottom line is that it's the judge's responsibility to do an affirmative action, correctly charge on an affirmative defense. And again, this isn't a case where the counsel stood up and said, you know, Your Honor, I really just don't want you to give this. We're going to do an all or nothing. You do see that when you have lesser included offenses. But getting back, I believe it was to Judge, now Chief Judge Baker's dissent in Gutierrez, then Judge Baker pointed out that when you are dealing with an affirmative defense, and you're dealing with an affirmative defense where the government retains the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the defense does not exist, then there is not or cannot be an affirmative waiver of that affirmative defense if it is one that the government is required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
So it's incapable of waiver. Is that your position?
Yes, in this instance, I would say that, Your Honor.
Okay, so you're...
But we don't get that. Yeah. To that point in this case.
Okay.
You don't dispute that the military judge instructed them that they had to be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that they were neutral combatants.
No, I don't dispute that. What I do dispute is the fact that he said that it can be restored if there is a good faith attempt to withdraw. What he did not add and should have added was that it can also be restored if there is an escalation of the violence or if there is an inability to withdraw. And that's the fact pattern that we have in this case with both of these killings was an escalation prior to each of the killings by the appellant.
Okay, and just to be clear, in your view, the escalation for the first killing was the shooting of a gun in response to being having a loaded weapon brandished.
The escalation was Heimer shooting at appellant. Appellant heard and shot.
Right, and so what is the escalation in the second killing?
The second one, Your Honor, had to do with appellant seeing that Sergeant Werner was about to stab Colvin. He steps into Colvin's shoes, in a manner of speaking, and moves to defend Colvin from this attack that Colvin does not know is occurring in back of him. The law does not require a knife thrust to be countered with a knife thrust. It only requires that the appellant use the degree of force that he actually believes is necessary under the circumstances.
And what had Colvin been doing just prior to being stabbed?
He was apparently on his knees and looking into the dining room or area where Heimer was. The record says no dot 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 Heimer, and we don't know exactly what the context of his voice was when he said that, but it may be very well, it would not be unreasonable to conclude that he was shocked at what had just happened to Heimer. He was distressed at what just happened to Heimer. Appellant turns around to see what Colvin is yelling about, and at that point sees Werner in back of Colvin, and at that point fires the gun at Werner. The questions from the bench earlier, Your Honors.
Counsel, you're on the clock. Is this responding to Judge Ryan's question?
I am shutting up now, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
You can do a two-sentence thing or ask for more time than that, but...
Your Honor, I'm finished. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will stand in recess until further order of the court, which happens to be tomorrow. Thank you.
The court stands in recess until 9:30 a.m. tomorrow.